This is the DTV Digest, the podcast that brings you news and reviews of films which didn't make it to the cinema. And now, here's your host, Mike Parkin.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the DTV Digest, the podcast which brings reviews of films which didn't make it to the cinema and instead went straight to DVD, Blu-ray, or streaming media. I'm your host, Mike Parkin, and joining me tonight are Richard Hawes.
Hello, everybody.
Stephen Lockridge.
Hello.
And our special guest is Timon Singh. Timon, good evening.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Timon is the founder of the Bristol Bad Film Club, the other BBFC. Contestant on Pointless. Can't forget that. Winner of Pointless, in fact.
I did not know this.
Yeah. Actually, full cards on the table. I've also been on Eggheads and Who Wants to Be a Millionaire.
Holy crap.
Yeah.
You've recently published the second volume of Born to Be Bad. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that, Timon?
Sure. A few years ago, I came up with the ridiculous idea of tracking down all the actors who had played the bad guys in my favorite action films growing up to find out whether if it is more fun to be a bad guy in an action film than a good guy. Because we all know about Arnie, Stallone, and Bruce Willis, but I wanted to know about the guys and their career after they'd been thrown off a building by the aforementioned good guys. So the first book, I tracked down, a lot of the terrorists from Die Hard, people like Vernon Wells from Commando and Mad Max 2, Sarah Douglas and Jack O'Halloran from Superman 2, David Patrick Kelly from The Warriors. A whole host of names. Oh, British actors like Paul Freeman from Raiders of the Lost Ark and David Warner from Time Bandits. And once the book was out and, lots of people seemed to enjoy it, there was just an itch at the back of my neck that I hadn't been able to get everyone that I wanted. So stupidly, I decided to write a follow-up, but I managed to get a host of great people like Tony Todd, Robert Patrick, Scott Adkins, Bei Ling, William Fichtner, Xander Berkeley, Sala Baker, who was Sauron in the Lord of the Rings trilogy. So yeah, that just came out a couple of weeks ago. So I'm just kind of recovering from that, and trying to publicize a book in a post-COVID world is really weird.
I read the first volume. I haven't had a chance to read the second yet. And you know, it was really insightful that the people you interviewed seem to be really keen to talk about those roles. Even the guy who played the South African in Lethal Weapon 2.
William Atherton. He passed a couple of years ago.
That's a shame. But because that was literally
William Atherton. Derek O'Connor. William Atherton's the guy from Ghostbusters and Die Hard. Sorry, Derek O'Connor.
Because if I remember correctly, that was one of his only sort of screen roles. He's more of a sort of stage actor, and it was just really interesting sort of hearing him sort of talking about his experience and sort of, and what he sort of brought to the role.
Yeah, he was an interesting one, because it was just a guy that kind of came to me off the top of my head, and he is best known for Lethal Weapon 2, but he's also in films like Hawkeye and Time Bandits and Deep Rising. And End of Days. The reason I said William Atherton is his character in Deep Rising is Captain Atherton. He's the head of the liner that Wes Studi and his gang of terrorists take over. He was very, very forthright about kind of his thoughts on the apartheid government during that time and why he took the role on, as well as kind of clashing with Arnie on the set of End of Days. So he was one of those actors who many of them were, who really did not give a shit and were very open in their stories and, their experiences, which was refreshing. Because if you're interviewing someone like Arnie or Stallone, they got a publicist and an agent and a manager looking over their shoulder, and they're not going to tell you anything you haven't heard 100 times before. But these guys were like, you want me to tell you who was a complete dickhead? Let me tell you who was a complete dickhead. And inevitably, the answer was Steven Seagal.
I can imagine, In the first volume, as I said, you interview Benny the Jet Akides and Bob. What was it, Bob Wall?
Bob Wall from Enter the Dragon.
From Enter the Dragon. And the stories they told. I mean, you know, especially Bob Wall talking about Enter the Dragon and Way of the Dragon, and you know, a perspective that a lot of people wouldn't have heard before. You know, his involvement in those films. It was really, really interesting to read, and Benny's anecdote about ending up in Hong Kong in a sort of death match kind of thing, and then talking to Frank Dux about it later on, you know, and it's like, oh, right, joining the dots now, you know, it's very interesting.
Yeah, I think lots of articles have been written about how Frank Dux may have embellished his career over the years, so this was just kind of like, you know, confirming what people had heard, really.
Absolutely. Looking forward to reading the second volume anyway. And where can people find it?
It's available at all tax dodging global corporate empires. But, you know, if you've got a local bookshop, order it in through your local bookshop and just pick it up there.
Absolutely.
And I just want to mention Ty, you also worked on In Search of the Last Action Heroes, the documentary, which is currently available to view on Amazon Prime.
I did. After my first book came out, I had just been fired from a job, and I saw this documentary that Oliver Harper was launching, was just going into its funding. And I just reached out to them and was like, I just wrote a book interviewing half these guys. And, you know, Stephen D'Souza, who wrote Die Hard and Commando and, you know, The Running Man, wrote the foreword, and I have his email right here. Would you like me to come on board as a researcher? And they made me a co-writer and a producer and sent me out to LA to do, you know, a big bulk of the interviews. So that was great. Yeah, it was fantastic. Yeah. I got to meet all, you know, all of these people I'd just interviewed over the phone, mm-hmm. and, you know, and also go to people like, you know, Cynthia Rothrock's house and just hang out with her for an evening and, you know, meet Eric Roberts and Philip Reed, the stars of Best of the Best. And, yeah, it was just great. It was like 12
dream come true kind of stuff.
It really was. It really was. And I'm really grateful to Robin Block, the producer, and Oliver, the director, for, you know, just taking a chance on me and yeah, and just making this big nerd's dreams come true.
Did you find it difficult to sort of to drive the conversation, you know, in a direction that you may have wanted, or, you know, to stop them sort of meandering and talking about other stuff?
I mean, the story that we were trying to tell was how, you know, action films changed from the 70s into the 80s, into the films we all know and love, and how, you know, the 90s changed action films again. You know, people like Arnie and Stallone turned into leaner action films like Keanu Reeves and Christian Slater and Brandon Lee. So we had a set template of questions, and then depending on who we're asking, we obviously had questions surrounding their projects and everything. Mm-hmm. We did have, you know, a couple of interviewing subjects who, let's just say, like to big up their own involvements. I mean, one of them was Mario Casar, the head of Carolco, that produced films like Total Recall, Terminator 2, Cutthroat Island, and Showgirls. And the man is very much, you know, he produced the Rambo films and produced Stargate and got people like Roland Emmerich and James Cameron to where they are. But at the same time, he's very much a kind of, you know, I've made no mistakes during my career. All the victories are mine, and all the failures were because of someone else. So, you know, you're trying to kind of get him to kind of go, but, you know, when these films didn't do as well, do you take any responsibility for that? It's like, nope, someone else, wasn't me. So, yeah, you're trying to kind of needle them into a not exactly the story you're telling. You're trying to get them to talk about things, and some of them are very guarded about, you know, demystifying their legend, if you will.
Sure, I can imagine.
Anyway, you must have been one of the last people to talk to Mario Casar, because he passed away, you know, not long after the movie was released,
was it? Andrew Vajna, his partner, his Hungarian partner.
Oh!
The other half of Carolco.
Mario Casar's
still very much alive.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
So Mario Casar, did he do Foxtrot 6?
He did. He is the producer on Foxtrot 6.
Yeah, yeah. So we're still waiting for that one over here.
Yeah.
We are, yeah. I'm still waiting for it because that came out, I think, a couple of years ago now in Indonesia.
Yeah. Anyway, we're here to talk about some new stuff. And we're going to kick off with Bruce Willis and Megan Fox in Midnight in the Switchgrass. Then we've got Kelsey Grammer and Julia Stiles in The God Committee. We've got a film called Union Bound. And then we're going to end up with A Deadly Legend. Our short shot is Cyberpunk 2077, The Phoenix Program. And then we got a bit of Burt Reynolds and who else is in this?
Angie Dickinson.
Angie Dickinson and
Mia Sara in The Maddening.
Stay tuned for that one. Okay, so without further ado, let's crack on. Our first review then is Midnight in the Switchgrass. A Florida police officer called Byron Crawford believes that a recent murder was committed by a serial killer, except his superiors don't want to hear about it. Instead, he teams up with FBI agent Rebecca Lombardo, but she may be putting too much on the line. Okay, so we've got Emile Hirsch as this police officer called Byron. Megan Fox playing Rebecca Lombardo, and her mentor, played by Bruce Willis. This film really could have done without Bruce Willis in it because he brings, again, nothing to the table except his name. Steve, you seen this one?
Yep. It's like United's generic down south thriller, really. Yeah, it wasn't very... I mean, like I said, Bruce Willis apparently filmed his scenes in one day, like usual. Very, very bland, I found it to be. There's nothing... You know, you've got your little kidnapped girl in trouble, the cop trying to find her, the FBI agent who's supposedly putting herself out there, trying to catch this serial killer, pedo... whatever, and it's just boring as hell. Nothing. I mean, I thought Emile Hirsch was quite good. Lucas Haas was all right, but it just dragged and dragged and never got out of second gear. To be fair, it was just there's nothing behind it. There's no tension, no suspense. It was just here. It is. You know exactly who it is. So. There wasn't even a whodunit element or anything like that.
There's no mystery as to who the kidnapper slash murderer is. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So Rich, I just found it very, very bland, to be fair.
Rich, we saw Bruce Willis the other week in Out of Death.
Yes.
How does this performance here compare for you?
Ah, so his performance is slightly better, but it's still not great, but it's not, his overall presence is not as detrimental to the production as in the case of Out of Death, where it's kind of his being there is kind of one of the most interesting things, even though it was terrible in it. This one is actually a really, for my money, I'd watched this back to back with Out of Death, was like a leaps and bounds better than Out of Death was. It's much less reliant on the Bruce Willis factor. It's got a very strong ensemble, whereas Out of Death didn't, you know, it's had Jamie King, but no one else really. This one's got, you know, really strong, you know, Megan Fox is really well known, very, very decent in what we've seen her in Rogue and everything recently. Emile Hirsch has been a very reliable actor. Lucas Haas has been around for donkey's years. I thought he was brilliant as the killer of the piece.
Do you know who he reminded me of in this? He reminded me of Ben Stiller.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
He really, really did remind me of Ben Stiller in this with his big ears. But there you go.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I wasn't thinking about the ears, but yeah, I was thinking about maybe his face so that I could see what he said. This is directed by Randall Emmett, who usually produces all the movies that on Arnold, Bruce Willis always appears in, like Out of Death. And I think because of that, maybe there's a bit more, you know, effort begun. I mean, this film's got cinematography, like proper cinematography in it. And, you know, there's been real effort made in making it a decent, proper movie, in for my money, compared to, like, the cheapest chips Out of Death, where it's just, you know, not worth a candle. How do you get on with it?
I agree with you. There is something here. But if this was, like, you know, if this was a novel by... who's the guy who did...
James Patterson?
Yeah, exactly. If this was, like, something by James Patterson, it would be, like, 60 pages long. You know, it's there's not a lot of meat here for them to really sort of do much with. I'll tell you a film this reminded me of, which is on Netflix, called The Night Hunter, with Henry Cavill and Ben Kingsley.
Oh, yeah, I know the one you mean.
I remember the one, yeah.
Yeah, because there's an element, you know, the thing that sort of Megan Fox is doing, you know, is reminding me of that film as well. But the most interesting thing about this was the cover version of Brothers in Arms. Because you know, I was watching it with the subtitles on, so it comes up saying Brothers in Arms, but not Dire Straits. But it sounded a lot like Dire Straits. You know, it's like we can't afford Dire Straits' version, so we'll do a cover, but it has to sound almost exactly the same.
And there was another scene in a bar which had a song that was clearly supposed to be Ace of Spades, but they couldn't afford to get Ace of Spades or something.
I did like this. I like Megan Fox's character. She has a couple of good confrontations with this pimp guy, which I thought sort of nailed her character really well. I thought she was the best thing in it for sure. I mean, Emil Hirsch is pretty good. Bruce was, what, 2-3 scenes I think he turns up in.
And I think as far as, in terms of being a serial killer thriller, I think the serial killer kind of scenes are, there are some scenes that are quite tense and unsettling, which is good. And I think that Lucas Huss really sells it quite well. I mean, I think he's played bad characters like this. I think he did While She Was Out with Kim Basinger, where he was, you know, sort of a low life character in that. But usually you think of him, you don't think of him as that sort of character. And I think I know it's a cliche, but the whole setup of, oh, he's a happy family man, but he's got this other side to him. Although it is a bit cliche, I think that's still a contrast that works quite well.
The film itself, you know, you mention its director was the centerpiece of an article written on Vulture a few months back, which sort of highlighted, you know, the use of like Bruce Willis in these sort of vehicles and basically called them geezer teasers, you know, sort of films which you know, rely on the name plastered on the sort of top of the DVD case, and yet sort of hardly featuring them, you know, get them in for a day or two to work and then that's it. And that's exactly what we get out of this, you know, as far as the name's concerned, which is a shame. You know, I think it's, you know, to the detriment of someone like Megan Fox, who is, you know, doing her best to sort of reinvent herself as an actress. And then, you know, she's lumbered with this, which is a bit of a shame. Yeah, but I think she does sort of stand out.
Speaking to the Bruce Willis of it all, and I have to say I have not seen this film, I was under the impression that when it comes to Bruce Willis appearing in films like this, it all comes down to getting financing and then also the distribution. It's always kind of like the old canon model of the 1980s. Mm. You've got a star attached and you know you can sell it to foreign territories that where someone like Bruce Willis still has a certain amount of cachet, even if he's only in it for 5 minutes. And you have to wonder at this point how much cachet having Bruce Willis in your film actually gets you, because I know someone who's written a script and it's getting made and it stars Bruce Willis and he's very excited, and I would be too if I wrote a script and Bruce Willis was starring in it. But you know that he's probably in there to get financing in there. He's probably going to do all his stuff in like 2 days. And at this point, is having Bruce Willis in your film almost like the opposite of a sign of quality? It's like a big flashing red light on your film.
Exactly. Well, I mean, if you think that, you know, what was the last film that he had actually in a cinema? It was
Death Wish.
Death Wish,
or maybe Red 2.
Red 2.
There was an interesting interview with Frank Grillo on the Happy, Sad, Confused podcast, and the interviewer, Josh Horowitz, actually kind of said, look, you've worked with Bruce Willis now a lot of times on films like Cosmic Sin. And it was after Frank Grillo said, look, I do a lot of rubbish and you know it's for the paycheck, you know, to kind of feed my family and whatnot. And Josh Horowitz was very upfront. He was like, Bruce Willis does not need the money. What's he doing in these kind of films? And Frank Grillo kind of hinted that Bruce Willis might be having certain health issues where he can't be on set for long periods of time. There wasn't any detail, but it seems to hint that the reason he's doing these films is because he still wants to act, but there are certain health concerns that means he can't do it for long periods of time.
I don't know. I don't buy it.
I don't buy it.
I think if he was really, I think even if, you know, if he's turning up in these films for even just a short amount of time, he could still be putting a lot more effort in if he really wants to be doing it. Mm-hmm. It's like you've only got to watch a couple of those scenes in Out of Death. You know, it's just like, what is he doing? You know, he really has clearly no interest. It's like there's no, I bet he's not even reading the script. He's just kind of coming up with stuff off the top of his head like Steven Seagal does.
Yeah, I mean, you would wonder why he just doesn't retire gracefully, like, you know, Gene Hackman. I was in Welcome to Mooseport. It didn't work out. I'm now going to retire and, you know, live on a ranch in Montana somewhere. But he, you know, he's still churning these things out, and he's got to know that people are, you know, well, mocking him, and that his star has fallen. So I'd really like to know why he's doing it.
It is strange to see all these guys sort of going the way of David Carradine and stuff. To you'd have thought these guys would never get, they would never become those guys. It's just sort of a strange thing.
Let's hope they don't literally go the way of David Carradine.
Well, I wasn't trying to take the conversation there. But...
Okay, guys.
No, but yeah, the concerns you've raised about, you know, that friend of yours with, you know, getting that, that was exactly my fear when I saw that news was announced, and I'm just really crossing my fingers and hoping for the best.
So, scores on the doors, guys. Steve,
I'll probably go 5.
Mm-hmm. And Rich,
no, 7 for me. Well, liked it.
I'm splitting the difference. I'm going 6. I think it was just a little bit too bland for its subject matter to really sort of push it. But it's a solid enough one, nevertheless. So that's a 5, a 6, and a 7 for Midnight in the Switchgrass. Our next review is The God Committee. Heart surgeon Dr. Andre Boxer is about to retire from the committee which prioritizes potential heart recipients. He is being replaced by his protege and former lover, Dr. Jordan Taylor. When a patient dies just prior to a transplant, the committee must decide quickly which of two patients is the more deserving. Now, we had to bump this film from last week because we had an absolute ton of films to review. And at the time, I was quietly grateful because this sounded on paper awful. It really did. At first, when it said The God Committee, I was thinking, oh, God, this is one of Rich's religious films. How has he managed to sneak this in here?
Hey! It's no Assassin 33 AD.
I love that film.
I know, I love that film as well.
I interviewed the director, but that's another story.
Right. Tymon.
Yes.
How did you get on? So this had Kelsey Grammer and Judith Stiles in it. How did you get on with The God Committee?
Well, I have to admit that I was very much like you when I saw the poster and it said The God Committee, and I was like, oh, look, knowing Kelsey Grammer's love for the Donald, I was like, this is going to be a faith-based film. It's going to be like one of those films with Kevin Sorbo and Robert Davi protesting Roe v. Wade or something. And instead, it was actually, you know, quite a thoughtful drama at, you know, what a fucking nightmare the American medical industry is, that, you know, hospitals rely on funding and, you know, the decision to kind of give someone a heart transplant is put up to this committee of doctors. And while you would think that they're doing it purely in the best interest of the patient, they're also weighing up other considerations, such as keeping the hospital in business. And it was much more thoughtful than I thought it was going to be. And I'm surprised this hasn't got somewhat of a limited theatrical release, considering the talent involved, especially Colman Domingo, who I would have thought has got a lot of clout from being in Fear the Walking Dead. He was in Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, and he's been in a host of things over the past few years. And I think he's out in Zola in cinemas this week. So I was really excited to see him in it. And he was great. And the cast was all great. And, you know, even Kelsey Grammer's character having a lover as young as Julia Stiles, I was like, this is a bit, oh wait, no, he's married to like a former air stewardess who's like 25. In that case, this is very believable. But I thought it was actually much more interesting than I thought it was going to be. Very well done. It didn't outstay its welcome. And I thought it shone a light on how fucked up the US medical system is. And I kind of enjoyed it. I did not enjoy Dan Hedaya's face. I don't know what he's done to himself, but he looked awful. I don't know if he's had work done, but it shocked me when I saw him appear on screen. But I kind of enjoyed this in a weird way.
Steve, did you get on with this one?
I agree with you guys. I mean, when we put it back, I was like, thank God for that. It just doesn't sound like anything I'd want to see. It just sounds, you can kind of see what it's going to be, but it was really riveting. It was so thoughtful. I mean, it's quite, the thing that disappointed me was it's quite basically shot. It could have been a TV movie. There was no real cinematic flair there. It was just basic, you know, camera in the room, pan here, pan there. That was the kind of thing that let it down. But I thought the script and the performances, the characters themselves were great. And like I said, the moral dilemma that these guys have to go through, because, you know, they'll be doing this kind of thing every single day, I presume. It's not just, you know, a one-off case. This is their job. This is what they do every single day. And it also introduces you to the other characters who could get the organ, you know, early doors, and then just this, it's one of them that actually builds the tension in the room. You know, kind of like 12 Angry Men. You don't need anything else, really. But then also, you've got a bit like the time jump to 7 years in the future. I think 7 years in the future, where, you know, Kelsey Grammer's now off doing something else, which could really, really revolutionise organ transplantation. And, you know, he's now got a son who's never met, and, you know, things like that. And it just really, really, I thought the script was absolutely excellent, and I really, really enjoyed it.
Cool.
Was it based on a play at all? Because it felt like it might have been a play.
It does say.
Yeah, by Mark St. Germain.
That makes a lot of sense.
Sure. Rich, so the consensus is pretty good at the moment.
Yeah, I agree. I liked it a lot. The film based on a play kind of thing can go one or two ways, and this was definitely not 9/11 starring Charlie Sheen.
Or Brighton.
That's kind of, I didn't see Brighton, did I? But that was the Stephen Berkoff one, wasn't it?
Yeah.
This high quality. I agree with Steve. You know, it's not really the kind of thing that's a movie kind of experience, because it is very much a play, but it's, you know, it's shot very well. It's a good quality drama. You know, it's an ethics drama. Probably a bit. I can kind of understand why it's, you know, a DTV thing. You know, COVID free times, you know, the normal cinema releases and such. And I still don't think it would have got a cinema release, but I think it's one of those films that's going to fly under the radar because it's not a genre film. Basically, it's not going to catch much attention. And I think, you know, the Kelsey Grammer factor is quite helpful. This is not Kelsey doing Money Plane kind of thing. This is a much more serious performance for him. But I think, you know, I think we've said it in the past or whatever. We've been really happy with all the Kelsey Grammer stuff, really, that we've seen. Generally, we think he's really good, and I think he's really good here. I mean, he's playing a very dark character. You know, he's kind of got this, you know, he's got this important position and everything, but he's really messed up. and when you show that leap into the future and how he's basically, you know, almost killing himself to try and, you know, reach his goals. You know, he's sacrificed everything. You know, he's got this terrible relationship with people. He's got a bad bad reputation as, you know, somebody, you know, don't want to be dealing with, but he's an excellent surgeon. You know, I think that's something that he pulled off really well. Julia Stiles was excellent, as was all the supporting. Yeah, the 12 Angry Men comparison is absolutely right, I would say.
Mm. Yeah, I totally agree with that. As I said at the beginning of this, I was not looking forward to watching this at all. And the opening segment with the car crash didn't really help, you know, because I thought, this is so much casualty. It really is. But then it sort of settled into it. And yeah, I was pretty much sort of mesmerized with it. Because it did become this sort of like medical procedural, you know, that's balancing these, you know, these people's lives in their hands. And, you know, one of them is a relatively upstanding sort of member of the community who's, you know, been following all their restrictions and things, you know, eating properly and trying to lose weight and all this sort of stuff. And the other guy's a complete shit, but a very rich shit. And his dad basically goes, oh, yeah, by the way, you know, I'd you know, if you save my son's life, I'll donate 25 million to your hospital. No pressure. And so you got that to weigh in, and you know, the ethics involved, because, you know, obviously if he's using drugs, he can't be fit for the program. There's his relationship with his girlfriend, and things that happen there, and every, you know, all this is sort of weighed into account through the course of the film. So yeah, it's it really did surprise me. Kelsey Grammer, as Rich said, you know, we're talking about Bruce Willis earlier and what he doesn't bring to the table, anything except his name, basically. It is clear that Kelsey Grammer loves to act. You know, he loves being an actor, he loves being in films, and it doesn't matter if it's something dramatic like this, or if it's a piece of pulp like Guardians of the Tomb, which I highly recommend, or something really, really bad like Money Plane. You know, and I've said it before, you know, just put, instead of having Bruce Willis, put Kelsey Grammer in all his roles. It would be so much more entertaining. Okay, any more comments before we get the scores?
I just want to go. I didn't have a problem with Dan Hedaya's face, like Ty was saying. Cause I didn't really notice that. All I noticed was, Jesus, Dan Hedaya looks basically exactly the same as he did in 1985.
He could not move his face. He looked more like who's the bad guy in Judge Dredd? Amand Asad.
Amand Asante.
Asante. He looked more like that. I was like, is that Amand Asante? And then I was like,
I agree. Yeah.
That is Dan Hedaya. What is going on? It might have been the slick back hair, but he did not have that expressive kind of face like that he had in Cheers and everything.
It was like his face couldn't move. It was like frozen, even his jaw. He could hardly open his mouth. You know, it was, yeah, I agree with you. It was a bit weird.
We're going to find out he's had a stroke and I'm going to feel terrible.
He's either had a stroke or he's been Mickey Rourke.
Yeah. It being Hollywood, I feel it's the Mickey Rourke version of events. But if it's not, to the Hedaya family, I can only apologise.
I think you'll find out when you interview him for Born to Be Bad 3.
Okay, guys. Before we get to... Sorry.
We didn't mention Janine Garofalo is also in this.
Oh, she's great.
She's sort of playing against type because she's not playing an acerbic sort of comedic character. She's like the head of the hospital. She's quite serious, and she plays a very significant role in the proceedings as well.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yes, very well cast film. Scores on the doors. Timon.
Is it out of 10?
Out of 10, yeah.
I would say it was a solid, 6. Good, entertaining drama, but I'm probably not going to remember it in a month's time.
Steve?
I'm going to go 7.
Mm-hmm. And Rich?
Yeah, I'll go 7 as well.
And I believe I am going to go 7. I can't believe I'm going to 7 because I just wasn't looking forward to seeing this at all. But
do you think the title's a problem?
Yes.
Yes.
When I saw the title written down, I thought, oh, God.
Do you think other people are going to be deterred from the film in the same way as you guys were all sort of a bit switched off from it? I'm not sure about this.
It all depends, because the UK doesn't have a big faith-based audience.
That's true.
Like America with the God is Dead and all those kind of films from Pure Flicks. So it's called the God Committee here. I think it will only be detrimental to the people that are kind of aware of those faith-based films and think it might be, oh, Jesus Christ, Kelsey Grammer is going to be railing against abortion, isn't he, or something. And until they read the back of the DVD or, the description on Amazon Prime, they won't know. But I think it might, the title is enough to kind of send some people running for the hills.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Yeah. But having said that, it's a bit like you last week, Rich, with Rot.
Yeah.
Yes.
Completely
subjective, isn't it?
Yeah, it's not what you think it's going to be. So. No.
That certainly isn't what you think it's going to be.
No, is it not? Is it for?
Okay, and so I went a 7 on this as well. So it's 3 7s and a 6 for the God Committee. Go check it out. Our next review is Union Bound. Okay, so this is from IMDb. Sergeant Hoover went to war to preserve the Union. After being captured and sent to a prisoner of war camp, he understood what it was like to be kept against his will. Together with a friend, he escaped and, aided by slaves, made it to freedom. The end. Okay, so the thing about Westerns... Rich, or films set in the Old West.
Well, this is the Civil War. It's not the Old West.
It's Civil War. It's the same thing, Rich. It's the same thing. Anyway, you know what I mean. You know what I'm talking about. They need to have a certain epic scope to them. But this is as flat as a pancake, basically. And nothing happens in it whatsoever, really. Not really.
Well, they run from one place to another.
They run from one place to the other, sort of like get ambushed, have a little fisticuffs, then run to another place, get ambushed, have a little fisticuffs, rinse and repeat, basically. And I don't know. I get confused with the American Civil War. Who were the South? Were the South the Union or the
Confederate? That's the Confederacy.
South, the Confederate. So yeah. the gray jackets,
the gray ones, exactly.
And the blue are the Yankees and the Unions. And
so these are the Unions, and they're sort of saying, there is an interesting thing about the Civil War is that so the people fighting for the North didn't really give a shit about slavery and all the rest of it, and really didn't think that sort of black people should be able to vote or be anything as we sort of saw for the next 100 years. Etc. And that's kind of, I suppose, what they're sort of trying to say here is that even though these guys are sort of Union soldiers, they had their eyes opened, the shackles fell from their eyes, etc., due to their sort of plight. But it's very, 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 very flat. How did you get on with this, Rich?
I wasn't looking forward to this at all. So it was the one I got out of the way first. But you know, a Civil War kind of movie is not really my thing. Ironically, Mormon history, you know, films, I'm there. You know, I love that sort of stuff. But, you know, Civil War, you know, reenactment kind of productions doesn't really do it for me. This didn't sell me. Although I think there are interesting things about it, then it's not a film that I can say that I particularly enjoyed, although it's, you know, it's in a, you know, inoffensive fare. But in it's low budget. I mean, it's like, it's, there's a lot of these, I mean, this is coming out through High Flyers, there's a lot of films of this type getting getting released, you know, the cast, essentially a cast of unknowns kind of movies. This one's slightly bigger because the one of the lead characters, Randy Wayne, he was in the Dukes of Hazzard DTV prequel as one of the brothers. So that's probably a fairly high profile role for him. And the main lead in this is our old friend Oliver Stone's son, Sean Stone, who we saw in Imprisoned just a few weeks ago with Mickey Rourke. His performance in this for me was similar to what it was in that. You know, he's not a particularly engaging lead. I think Randy Wayne probably did a slightly better job, slightly more engaging. But really, I wasn't that bothered about it. And then we've also got Tank Jones in there as the slave who basically escapes with them and helps them for a period of time. I mean, it's not like it's the three of them on the run for the whole story or anything. It's a very sort of limited part, apart from say the Oliver Stone son factor and bits like that, the fact that it's based on a diary of a real soldier, it makes it quite interesting as they've taken these sort of facts and sort of tried to embellish them and make this story. It'd be interesting to know if they've taken many liberties. I mean, there's only so much you can take from, you know, from what I presume it was quite a short diary entries, I would presume. But that gives it quite interesting.
The thing about that diary is that, you know, there's two of them escape. So they, you know, both sharing this adventure, as it were. And he doesn't even bother naming him in his diary. You know, he sounds incredibly self-centered. You know, it's like, yes, I was doing this, and oh yeah, there was this other guy following me around. You know, that's kind of the way it sort of comes across. You know, because you get this epilogue that sort of says, oh, we think it may have been this guy who was also helping him, you know, escape from the south. And again, you know, the slave character, they haven't got a clue. A much better film in terms of entertainment from this period came out a few months ago called Emperor, which again is also built sort of based on actual events.
Is that Civil War period drama then?
It's set before the Civil War.
Oh, okay.
It is, you know, much more action-packed. It really does embellish things a lot, especially the end of the film. If you actually read the events of what happened at this this arsenal and what happens in the film, you know, they go out of the way to sort of make it as action hero-y as possible, which is really cool. All that's missing is the ninjas. But, I the issue I have with any sort of like Civil War drama that we see these days, it really does feel like it's a sort of one of these historical reenactment societies, you know, getting to bring out all their equipment and stuff and get, you know, dust off their uniforms and all
which that. They definitely did in this, because there's loads of them. There's a couple of scenes where they clearly just called everyone in.
Exactly. There's you know, and this stupid stuff. There's 5 minutes of watching these people fish. Literally on screen for 5 minutes, they're just fishing. You know, trying to catch a fish. It's ridiculous. It's almost like a YouTube tutorial. Yeah. it's just not needed at all. You know, you don't need this for your film. You don't need to sort of see how they ate all the way along. But there you go.
A few weeks ago, we saw Blood Brothers, which was not set during the Civil War, but it was post-Civil War
but it
drama.
Feel, it, the drama felt a lot like this. The quality of the actors,
yeah.
The sort of dialogue, it did feel a lot like this.
Yes, but to which I was going to say, but I like that one a lot more. I thought that one, I mean, I know you guys, you didn't get on with it, but I actually was much more engaged with that one than I was with this particular story.
Sure. Okay, how are you going to score this one, mate?
3.
Wow, you're making me feel generous now. I was going to give it a 4. So a 3 and a 4 for Union Bound. The thing is, Rich, despite our low scores, we both know that this is going to do quite well. Because any sort of war film has its audience in this country, as we well know. So, yeah, I expect to see this in the DTV
in
chart.
The chart, yeah. I think you're right. I think it'll probably, you know, on the sort of design of the package, you know, the post, the cover art alone. I mean, which is pretty bland, to be honest, for the UK release. They've not the original American poster is quite nice. It's got the, you know, the actors and stuff on it, and the UK one, they've just stripped that all completely. Basic, and you know, there's nothing basically apart from the title and a shot of a cannon or something. One of those really not great
who's,
covers.
Which distributing it out of interest?
This is High Flyers.
Oh, okay,
they can do better. Okay, so as I said, that's a 3 and a 4 for Union Bound. It'll be out soon. Our next review is A Deadly Legend. This is from IMDb. The reason I'm reading this from IMDb is because I have no clue what was going on. Okay, Joan Hunter is a real estate developer. She buys an old summer camp. It turns out that the property was once inhabited by a rogue sect of pagans with a dark history of sacrificial worship. A celebration weekend with friends turns deadly when construction uncovers a mythical Stonehenge of America. Oh my God. Deadly spirits are awakened and killed to gain control of the supernatural gateway. Right. I didn't get any of that from the film, I must admit. Nope. Timon, I know you have issues here, so have at it.
I mean, I don't want to upset you guys, but this is everything I hate about direct-to-video films. It looked awful. The problem with a lot of direct-to-video films, I find, is they look like they were just shot on the cloudiest of cloudy days. They're so faded and saturated and grey. And then when they're shooting things at night, it's clearly daytime and they've just put a dark blue filter on it. It just looks like they've got some friends round and like shooting a party scene. Everyone's a terrible actor. I didn't know what tone they were going for. I looked at the IMDb description and they said it was like a dark comedy.
Yeah.
And I'm only putting that down to like what Tommy Wiseau says about The Room, where it's clearly meant to be a drama, but because people find it hilarious, he rewrote history and said it's actually a dark comedy. I get the feeling this was meant to be a straight horror. People found it hilarious and they've gone, oh, it's a comedy horror.
We meant to do that. Yeah.
Okay. Oh God, the acting at the beginning, there was like some friend who was dressed like, I thought it was a porno. She was just like in this tight red top, pretty much spilling out of it. And I was like, is this going to turn into a porno? And then Laurie Petty showed up and I just felt sad for Laurie Petty. And that was before I'd seen Judd Hirsch. And Judd Hirsch just, I don't know if he owed people money. I don't know what they had on him. He just said these lines going, I'm going to disturb evil, and then wandered off. And then when Laurie Petty showed up, my heart sank, playing some sort of drunkard.
She's in a different movie.
He's in a different movie.
Oh, God, then, yeah.
Was she playing that character? Was that Laurie Petty?
Laurie Petty of Tank Girl and Point Break.
Oh my God, the tone of that was just awful.
And then it kept cutting to the ghost, the most talkative ghost I've ever seen. Me and my wife have been watching, because she'd never seen them, the Insidious and the Conjuring films. So, I mean, that kind of shows you what films we've been watching of late. And this ghost wouldn't shut up. She's just standing there kind of dictating the plot, who she is, what she wants. Yeah. And I was like, is this meant to be scary? I'm just bored. And as a result, after like the third or fourth cut to the digger guy getting drunk and trying to dig something up and failing, I gave up. I gave up, guys. I couldn't do it to myself. But I'd love to know if it got better.
Nope.
Steve? Okay. Excuse me. Steve, did it get any better?
No, it was shite. I'm sorry, but like you said, you've had to read that off IMDb. I didn't have a clue what was happening. Not a clue. I think what they've done is they've done the script, they've run out of money, and they've just skipped certain scenes that would fill the story in, because none of it made a lick of sense. And you're right, when Laurie Petty showed up, I was like, no. I felt sorry for her. It was an absolutely awful performance. Having said that, her boyfriend, Mike, was it called, in the digger?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He was just, if I just open my eyes really wide, that's my performance. And it was absolutely diabolical. The effects were terrible. And then you've got the Chinese girl kind of died, but then came back from the dead. Was killing everyone. It was a battle between the two factions, apparently. And no, it didn't make a lick of sense. And I don't mind sometimes, you know, if the acting's bad, so long as the story's good. But it was all over the place. It really was.
Rich.
See, I didn't dislike it as much as you guys, I'll be honest. I mean,
God bless you, Rich.
Now, if you want to play, if you want to do a drinking game with this, there's plenty of opportunities. But one of them is Fade to Black, because this is the most Fade to Black film ever. It's like how many, like literally, the end of every scene is a Fade to Black. Drove me mad. I hate that. It's such an overused device. But and it didn't fit. And also some of the cutting between the scenes just was very abrupt, and that just didn't really work. It was very, very strange. Yeah, it is very, very low budget, and I'd put it on par with some of the fan films that we watch, like Voorhees. Mm-hmm. But it's like there are fan films out there that do this. So you've got a film that's really, really low budget, but they've managed to get in some recognizable stars or whatever. This is cheapest chips production, one of the cheapest we've seen lately. But they've managed to get, and this might be where the budget's gone, but they managed to get in Judd Hirsch and Laurie Petty and Corbin Burnson. And Corbin Burnson's actually quite, you know, in quite a lot of it. You know, he's one of the major characters, whereas Judd Hirsch is kind of comes in. He's the kind of "you're all doomed" kind of character. And then he's gone until possibly might turn up again later. But yeah, it is confusing. I kind of admired the fact that it had so much going on, even if it was confusing, you know, the fact that it wasn't just here's the deadly ghost or whatever that's come back from the dead, possess someone, they're going to kill you all, and that's it. That there's this other element. It's kind of the way I love Halloween, The Curse of Michael Myers. It's just like, it could be quite a straightforward, Michael Myers is back and he's just going to kill everyone. But they go, no, he's a cult, and the cult's doing all this stuff or whatever, and it's all going. This doesn't have the budget or anything of anything approximating that. This is really, really low budget. But I did kind of admire those aspects of it. They try to throw in too much, because they got the fancy elements. You got the girl with the chains. They try to sort of CGI the chains so one of them floats around a bit, because they go, there's a bit early on where they're on a float in the water, and the chain comes up and grabs around the leg and ankle, and drags her in. And that was sort of looking a bit, it looks a bit cheesy or whatever. And then they kind of do this tearing the fingernails off kind of thing.
Yeah.
Which was, that's going to come up again later, coincidentally. But but for the most part, it feels more like a fantasy film than a horror film. It's all shot in the daylight, I think, for the most part. Mike, the digger driver who goes mad in that sort of shadow builder kind of way, he's actually the writer of the movie. I liked him. I liked his performance. I liked that, he's crazed and they're coming after him. And they're trying to shoot him with nail guns or whatever, and he can't stop him. And then it cuts to another thing, and it's kind of it's moving to and fro from all these different plot elements. And I think they probably just bit off more than they could chew. But I think I found it quite entertaining.
I think we finally found a film which makes The Witches of Amityville look relatively good.
No. Not that bad.
It's not that bad. Right. Look, no. It's, I wasn't joking when I didn't understand what was going on. I got the impression that the people who wrote this had never seen a horror movie at all, ever.
I just want to mention, did you notice that, Mike is at the mound and he's supposed to be taking apart this mound or whatever with his digger? Mm. Did you notice they never really showed it?
Yeah,
that was weird. I didn't see anything. Yeah,
no, exactly. It kind of reminded me, do you remember when we watched Yeti and they were like, they were going outside and they were looking at this stuff in the ground or whatever, and they clearly didn't have the money for the prop or something. Mm. So it was like, what are you looking at?
There's, So we get the bit at the beginning when they sort of buy the land and everything, and they have the council meeting, and someone's going, "You can't dig up the mound. The mound is sacred," and all this sort of stuff.
Judd Hirsch.
So you get, "Ooh, the mound, eh? Quite scary stuff." And then you have the bit in the lake where the girl gets sort of dragged to her death, and it's like, so there's something in the lake that we need to be aware of. What happened to the mound? It's like, well, make up your mind. Is it the lake? Is it the mound? I don't know what's going on. There's a lengthy flashback, sort of 100 years ago.
Which
they're going to sacrifice somebody, and then this sort of demon woman turns up and starts killing people. And
that was 50 years ago, I think. That's where the twist at the end comes in.
No, I thought it was even earlier than that, because the sort of swords and knives and stuff, and all of a sudden the shot rings out, and there's like a union militia or something. I'm like, it's almost as if they went, "Oh yeah, we got guns now." We can just shoot the witches for fuck's sake. We don't have to worry about all the rest of it. But yeah, there's just it's a thing, basically. I was not impressed.
And I was really, really confused by the ending of the film, the epilogue. I did not understand what was happening there at all. I don't really want to say what it is because I don't want to spoil it, but it's kind of one of those endings where you think, well, was this all something that was happening, or is this actually something that's actually happening after the events of the film? Mm-hmm. That kind of thing. I just didn't understand. It didn't make any sense to me.
Didn't make any sense. No. Didn't really care by that point. Okay, scores on the doors. Timon?
I'd have to give it one.
It's a low score. Steve?
I'm going a 3.
Mm-hmm. Rich?
I'm going to give it a 5.
All right, I'm giving it a 3 as well.
You guys are very generous. I respect that. I respect where you're coming from, or you must have seen some terrible stuff in your time.
We've seen things, man. We've seen things.
Yeah, we do this like week in, week out.
I think we do have a certain appreciation for the effort that goes in to some of these films, and we can turn a blind eye to bad acting a lot of occasions, even day for night shooting, if the story serves it, but this was a low point.
This is not a million miles away from like Rogue Hostage. There's not a big leap because there's no effort with the cinematography. It's all basically shot in daylight, limited locations and whatever. There's not a lot between those two. I mean, I'm sure the budget difference was massive between this and that film in particular. But yeah, they sort of blend together. It's the lack of effort on cinematography. One of the things that really bothers me. I like a film to look like a film, and yeah, if this had been shot a bit better, I'd probably give it another point. But it does feel like it's shot on video.
Yeah, it's one of those reasons I'm scared of direct-to-video war films, because you know it's 80% of the time it's five guys in the woods in Herefordshire or something, yep. And you're like, oh, I can't be bothered with this.
No, we've seen plenty of those. Even things like, is it Sinners and Saints 2? I think it is.
I still have the original Saints and Sinners? Where, but at least I had production value. They had half tracks and tanks. But
yeah, there are sort of a few things. And there's one with Tom Berenger did recently about Battle of the Bulge.
Is that War Pigs, where Dolph Lundgren's?
No. Winter War, okay. Battle of the Bulge. I think
again,
it was called.
Very low budget, you know, and again, it is so that sort of, you know, World War II historical reenactment society lending them their equipment. This is a low point, unfortunately. And I think, you know, if they'd given the script a few more revisions and jettisoned some of the material, you know, that they may have had something. But thought, there you go.
They got something here. it's something. Fade to black. That's the end of that review.
Definitely technically a film.
Okay, so what do we get out of that? Have we got 2 3s, a 1, and a 5? Is that right?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, so a deadly legend? See, I've even forgotten the name of the film now. Our short shot this week is Cyberpunk 2077, The Phoenix Program. I'm going to be really, really facetious and basically say that this is based on a video game, and it features a guy entering a building trying to find his girlfriend and killing lots of people in between. Timon, what do you make of this one?
Well, I'm not familiar with the Cyberpunk 2077 game. I know that it exists, and I know that Keanu Reeves is in it, and that's the extent of my knowledge. So I have a strange relationship with fan films, especially fan films like this, where there is clearly lots of money and lots of talent involved. And then I feel frustrated when clearly very talented filmmakers and actors handcuff themselves to an IP where they can't do anything with it due to copyright laws. And it's like, you have made a very, you know, well done action film, and granted, that's all it is for 40 minutes. It's just the Keanu Reeves lookalike walking into various parts of this, you know, well-lit and put together warehouse and beating the shit out of people. And that is fine. That is great. But I don't, if you've got all this talent, and there is a lot of talent in this, I don't get why do a cyberpunk film. And I feel the same every time I see, like, you know, people spending lots of money on a Batman fan film or a Star Trek fan film. It's like, I get the passion, but I don't know what the end game here, because no one has ever been hired by a studio to make a Batman film off the back of any of these fan films. And I just feel that if they did their own original short film, like a short action film or a short superhero film, it might not get as much attention as like a Batman fan film, but I feel studios might sit up and take notice more than if it's just a fan film. But I feel I'm kind of going completely off piste with this. It was very well done. It was pretty, I want to say a little bit samey. After 20 minutes, I was like, okay, is he going to walk into this room? Yeah, he's going to beat these people up. Right, great. That was a cool move. What now? Oh, he's going to beat these people up as well. Okay, cool. So I admire it for what it was. I think it could have been a bit tighter, but everyone involved clearly got a lot of talent. I just hope they put this talent to better use, because I want them all to do well in their career. And I just feel that any people that just kind of make a fan film like this are semi-shooting themselves in the foot in terms of future work. But that's just me. I might be proved wrong. Someone might have got a great job out of this, or a fan film that I'm just not aware of. But I just remember this guy that did, what, Batman Dead End, where Batman was fighting a predator.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, you know, the internet was lauding this fan film. And as far as I'm aware, he's never made a feature film.
He did. So,
he did, Hunter Prey.
Did he? Yeah, Hunter Prey. Well, fuck me being wrong.
I don't think it did that well, but it... No.
Fuck me, my justification returns.
Sandy Carolla was his name.
That's it. Sandy. Is this the guy that claims to have designed the Jurassic Park logo or something?
I have no idea about that bit.
It's a very weird thing. Like, there's this father and son team that make these very well done Batman films, but Warner Brothers are never going to come knock on their door and kind of go, do you want to make the next Batman film? That's not how it works. So it's kind of like, they can't make money off this because, you know, Warner Brothers owns license to Batman. So it's kind of like, I feel if they just put all this talent and money to something original that they could then own. But, you know, what do I know? If making Batman films makes them happy, Godspeed.
Indeed. Steve, we've seen a lot of, as Tyron said, we've seen a lot of fan-made films. How did this compare with some of the others we've witnessed?
To be honest, I kind of agree with Tyron. It's one of them. It's done well. It looks great. But there's no... Like I say, I've not played the game myself.
I don't think many people have because of the bugs that came with it.
Well, apparently, yeah. Everyone was raving and then it came out and it was dog shit, apparently. But there's no emotion there. You're not invested in any character or anything. It's just, let's walk to another room, kick the shit out of everyone, then do the same thing in another room. And don't get me wrong, the fighting's great. It looks really good. But there's absolutely no emotional investment there whatsoever. And yeah, after 40 minutes, it's samey, you know. It's near, not as bad as that 400 Samurai thing the other week, but, you know, it's kind of the same thing. It's just, oh, we'll shoot people in this room. We'll use knives in this one. We'll kick and punch in this one. And it was just okay, you know.
This might be an unpopular opinion, but I don't think a fan film should be longer than 15 minutes. Personally, I think one of the best ones that I've seen is, did you ever see that Uncharted fan film that Nathan Fillion did with Stephen Lang as Sully?
Yep.
No.
It's really well done. It's fun. It looks great. And it's not longer than 15 minutes. And Nathan Fillion knows he was never going to get cast as Nathan Drake. And, you know, they went with him. But this is just clearly him scratching that itch. And they just did a 15-minute short film. And it's good. It's fun. It hits all the right beats. It doesn't outstay its welcome. And you're done. Whereas this, it was 40 minutes of...
Yeah.
The same stuff. Very good same stuff, but the same stuff.
So this is my issue with this film, Rich. We've seen a lot of fight scenes dressed up as short films. And basically, that's what this kind of feels like. Even though, you know, the production values are really good, the action is well choreographed. But essentially, this is just yet another fight film, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yes, but I am a bit disappointed by your lack of enthusiasm because I absolutely love this. I watched it the second time. I was like, oh my God, I've got to tell everyone about it. It's so amazing. Yes, it is to a certain extent, I could criticize it. I'd criticize other films for basically being as threadbare in the story department. I think there's a fraction more.
Yeah.
But you know, like when I watched that film, A Care, or whatever, Ross Peacock's film, how excited I was to see it, and then when I actually saw it, it was like, well, it's just a fight, and I wanted more. This kind of does it's just a fight, but multiplied by like seven. It's like a continual string of fights. But at the same time, I do think there was a bit more substance. But yes, there's no story here, really. It is just a series of set pieces. But boy, what set pieces.
Yeah. You do also get the impression, I mean, you know, none of us have played the game, but you could tell they were sort of bringing elements of the game into the film, especially the sort of design of it and the sort of, you know, the special powers that certain characters had. You know, there's a scene early on where guys sort of using sort of like ESP or something to control his hands, you know, so he's going to shoot himself. And by the way, the way he gets out of that was really, really well done. I thought that was an excellent moment. But it is sort of, you know, glowing eyes and it's sort of beat people up again. And it's great for what it is, but I don't know, it just needs to be a bit more.
I think I might have been spoiled because I go to the Fighting Spirit Film Festival, like we mentioned before. And I think the last one I went to, Max Huang, who's part of the Jackie Chan stunt team and was in the recent Mortal Kombat film. They showed his short film, No Way Out, that's 20 minutes long.
Awesome film.
I've just put a link to it in the chat. And that is just a fight film for 20 minutes, but it's constantly changing and it's intense. And compared to something like that, and look, I know these guys aren't part of the Jackie Chan stunt team, but the fight scenes in this were a bit repetitive and it was more of the same for 40 minutes compared to like a tight 20-minute film that comes in, blows your socks off, and then leaves without overstaying its welcome. I feel there is a really tight, good cyberpunk 2077 fan film in here. And it could be because I'm unfamiliar with the source material, but it felt like it got very self-indulgent.
Do you think it's fair to say that it's as much a John Wick fan film as a cyberpunk fan film?
Yes. I think the Keanu Reeves link doesn't really help it in that regard. Mm. So yes, and there was lots of, you know, judo flips and that stuff. So I don't know if this is part of Cyberpunk 2077. This is why Keanu Reeves is in it. But the guy was definitely channeling Keanu, so
I mean, that's the whole point of it, is that he's a cosplay guy who's also an excellent stuntman, so they've cast him as Keanu Reeves playing Johnny Silverhand rather than being himself. Maul cosplay is his name, credited name. Ben Sharma, I think, is his real name, but he's played Darth Maul in the short film Darth Maul Apprentice. And him and the director of this, who is V. Dan Tran, who's got tons of stuff on his history, action designer for Into the Badlands and Shang-Chi and The Legend of the Ten Rings.
Oh, that's cool.
Whole loads of Skyfall he's done stunts. Tons of stuff he's done, including, I think, what's the thing? They did, these two guys, the star and the director, they did an Assassin's Creed video game tie-in short. So it wasn't a fan film. It was an official, like, made by the video game company.
This, if anything, reinforces my thing. This guy has clout. He's worked with these studios and he's working with big, you know, big deals like Disney on Shang-Chi and everything. So why is he wasting his time doing a short film for Cyberpunk 2077 when he doesn't own the rights, when he can go off and do something awesome and get more work off the back of it? Because there's no way he's going to make any money off this.
I think it's the same reason that, you know, Hollywood makes sequels and franchise stuff. Is by virtue of the fact that it is a property, that it is going to get noticed. It obviously hasn't worked a huge amount because pretty much everyone in the action community who I've mentioned this to hasn't seen it and doesn't know of it, which is a shame. So I don't know. I think that might be it. I think there's also that wish fulfillment thing of, you know, you know, people, especially the people on the lower end who don't have the kind of careers that this guy has, who are making their Batman films and whatnot, is that they want to live the dream. You know, they want to sort of be part of that world and create their own stories and stuff. And I completely get that. And I admire that. And I think there's some really fantastic stuff out there. I mean, there's so much Friday the 13th films that I'm discovering. I had no idea there were so many of them. But the budgets they're able to get, and, you know, the way things have shot up with crowdfunding. You know, the whole crowdfunding thing's basically revolutionized all this stuff. You know, they're making much higher quality things. Then you had things like Axanar coming up, and
oh god, yeah,
Paramount saying basically you're getting too big for your boots and we're gonna sort of hammer down. But then on the flip side, you've got the Star Wars stuff, who they basically kind of embrace it and say, yeah, go on, you know, do what you want, but don't go too far. And there's some fantastic Star Wars shorts out there, and I think this for me is one of the if you take the fan film side out of it, because I'm not really worried about that, just as an action film, for me this is the best action film I've seen all year.
It is interesting about how different studios treat fan films, because like you said, I remember seeing that prelude to Axanar short, and as a Star Trek fan I was like, this is really cool. And then they started, like you said, they did start getting too big for their boots. They were like making, you know, Enterprise sets, and I think the creators started publicly bashing the direction the Paramount was going. So I think Paramount was like, well, let's kind of put these guys in their place. And I think because of where Discovery was going, they're also like, you are treading ground that we might be treading. So, but yeah, Disney or Lucasfilm let Star Wars fans do whatever they want. You don't see that many Marvel fan films, interestingly, so I wonder what goes on there. But yeah, the Star Trek fan film community is interesting. Warner Brothers don't seem that bothered by all the Batman fan films out there. So it's really interesting. I'd be interested to know where certain studios and IP stand in regards to fan films. Because in these days when special effects can be so good and done at home, it seems to be like a really financially and legally grey area.
Yeah.
Just as an aside, if you haven't seen Marvel Zombies versus Army of Darkness, I definitely highly recommend checking that out. That's got like, it's a, you know, horror take on Spider-Man and stuff appear in it. But then you've also got Ash from the Evil Dead and stuff. That's really, really clever, really well made.
Cool. Anyone can put up a green screen these days, you know, so yeah, as you say. Okay, so we don't score the short shots, but we do recommend you check them out. You will find a link to this in the footnotes below, so please check it out. Our DTV throwback this week is The Maddening. After another fight with her husband, Cassie Osborne takes her daughter to see her sister, but takes a detour which gets herself abducted by a deranged couple. Meanwhile, her husband is hit by the police, who believe he's murdered her. Okay, so this stars Burt Reynolds and Angie Dickinson and Mia Sara, and is a psychological horror movie, which just seems crazy to think about. None of us had seen it before, I believe. Is that right, Rich?
Well, I'd seen it when it came out.
Really? Jesus.
1995 it came out. I saw it back then.
Okay. So, Timon, I know you hadn't seen this before. What on earth do you make of The Maddening?
I really enjoyed it. I watched it with my wife, who is very much into these kind of films. And, you know, I said, I've got to watch this, you know, old 90s film called The Maddening. Do you want to watch it with me? She went to IMDb, read the description. I was like, yep, yeah, I'm in. And I had a lot of fun with it. I don't think my wife was as impressed as I was, but, you know, it's a little, you know, DTV thriller directed by Danny Houston. Danny, if you're looking for a villain who's clearly, obviously, the villain, Houston.
The guy always confused with Vincent D'Onofrio.
I really enjoyed it. You know, it's like one part Misery, one part Psycho. I'll admit I kind of lost track on what Burt Reynolds' character might have done and who Maya Sara's character and her daughter was meant to be, but I think I got it in the end. but it was a nice tight little thriller. The part that threw me was the subplot involving Josh Mostel's police officer, Chicky Ross, who was dressed like Dennis Nedry from Jurassic Park. And every time he appeared on screen, there was like an umpire score kicked in. I was like, this is really not complimenting what's going on in the other scenes. It's like really odd.
I think it's like a prototype. He's a prototype of Daniel Craig's character in Knives Out.
Maybe.
It's that same sort of tone.
and was the neighbor, what's her name's mum from Frasier? She was like in her own little thing. But I kind of enjoyed it. Burt Reynolds, I know this is in his like slum period before Boogie Nights revived him, but he seemed to be going all in. Angie Dickinson was going all in. Maya Sara, I was like, yeah, what did happen to her post Ferris Bueller and Time Cop? And it turns out she's married to Brian Henson of the Henson family. Oh. So good for her. But I really enjoyed it. I thought Brian Wimmer, who played her husband David, was a total waste of space. He should kind of really get a suit that fits. And the argument that left to her storming down to Tampa, me and my wife found hilarious. She just flies off the handle so quickly over, you know, his job. But you know what? I enjoyed it. I really did enjoy it.
Mm-hmm. Steve, did you watch this one?
Yeah. Wasn't as enthusiastic, shall we say. The husband was absolutely terrible. It just didn't grab me. I thought it was the way it was done. It was, how do I explain this now? Because he wasn't just a straight up psycho, because it was more to do with what's gone in his past. I mean, they tried bringing that into it, you know, kind of murdering his own child, being kind of abused by his dad, who was seeing in his own head, in his old wheelchair and things like that. And it just didn't sit with me right. And especially like the sister as well, and her husband, them two were just, all them three, her husband, sister, and his sister's husband, they were just annoying as fuck.
Oh, basically. Those scenes were hilarious. They were in a completely different film.
Yeah, that's what I mean. It just didn't, there's no consistency there, you know. And I just couldn't get into it at all.
I do agree that tonally and consistently, it was wildly over all over the place, like I was talking about with Chicky Ross. But if anything, that kind of endeared it to me a little bit more. I don't know why.
Rich, you recommended this. It's your fault. What did you make of it in the end?
Well, I don't remember much about it from when I first saw it. I mean, when I was growing up, I was a fan of Burt Reynolds. And so as soon as this came out, I was all over it. But I don't really remember much about it. So I really enjoyed the fact that it's turned up on Prime and had a chance to revisit it. It's in widescreen, which is nice because I'd only ever seen it in pan and scan. And I'm coming at it from a different perspective. Now, when I first saw it, I didn't take note of the director or whatever. I didn't have anyone. I mean, Danny Houston, when he directed this, you know, this is 5 years before he even started his proper acting career, when he was in Time Code from Mike Figgis and then started doing other stuff. So I became familiar with him at that point. This is like way before. So this was a real surprise to me to realize that he directed this. It's the only film I think that he's, I think there's one other film that he's directed more recently that he starred in.
Yeah, Mr. North, but that was in 1989 with Angelica Houston.
He directed one before this, did he?
Yes, he directed.
Yeah, and I think he directed one since as well. Am I right?
I'd have to look it up. Let's have a look.
Okay.
You keep talking, I'll look this up.
Yeah, no. That's an interesting fact, but you know, there's not really much. I mean, there's a couple of bits of framing and stuff that you think, maybe that's an homage to his dad, John Huston, whatever. But I came for Burt Reynolds. I'm not massively familiar with Angie Dickinson, but you know, I know who she. I know she's, you know, of the same era and that. So this is quite a big thing, the two of them in this movie and playing these roles. It's good. I like talking to Angie Dickinson for a second. I think she could have very easily played the hysterical, played the character as hysterical, but she very much underplays it, which I think works much better. I think there's, and I like that. I agree that Burt Reynolds does seem to be all in on this. He's, I think he's very powerful in a couple of the dramatic scenes. You know, when he's getting very emotional and stuff. I think there's, especially like the scene with his father, where he's talking about his dad and stuff. I think he's really, really doing some of his best work there, I would say. And you know, he also does well with, you know, because he plays with his charming persona. You know, it's, you know, he's doing his you know, Smokey and the Bandit kind of thing a little bit, and then he's completely sort of twisting it, which I like. The film itself, yes, it's uneven, but I think it's got this. There's a campiness to it. It's got like this camp tone, and that's why he's got like the Chicky Ross character, the guys at the gas station who keep thinking that, oh, do you know Ozzy Osbourne? Because your name's Osbourne, kind of thing. They keep throwing in all these weird sort of side characters, and like the sister and all the supporting sort of characters are very sort of weird, and then the family themselves are quite weird. You know, the daughter who's being raised in this crazy environment, she's obviously, you know, gone a bit crazy from it herself. So, you know, there's lots of madness in the air. So I think it's quite intentional. How much of this comes from the source novel Playmates, I'm not sure, but I think it's quite, I mean, it seems to have a reasonable budget. You know, they've used the resources they had well. I really like Burt Reynolds in it. And there's a bit where, to reference A Deadly Legend, there's a fingernail sequence, which was, you know, I just couldn't watch the screen at that. Yeah. That was pretty horrible. Mia Sara's really good. I thought I felt the film almost could have done without the husband character, but he's kind of, as I think Ty, you were saying, like Psycho, the Psycho influence seems to be very much apparent from that aspect of, you know, he's going to come.
I honestly thought, and hopefully this doesn't spoil it for anyone, but when Burt Reynolds catches him at the beginning and gets him with the chain, I was like, oh, that's awesome. They just kill him. and alas, it turns out he's just been thrown down a well that he somehow survives. So he's like killed twice and somehow survives it. But I was kind of like,
do you like William Hickey?
Yeah, something like that. But it was, I was also impressed with like the young 4-year-old actress who was kind of out acting the hysterical blonde child in every scene. It was a really odd one, but yeah, I agree with you about the campy and even tone. I think I found that much more entertaining than my wife did. I think maybe it didn't blend too well with the themes of incest and rape that was kind of going on.
It was there in the background, wasn't it? But it was
for some reason I did find myself really enjoying it.
I didn't think I didn't get the incest thing. I didn't really pick up on any of that.
I think it was more so. Let's break it down. The Arthur was his son that he had had with his wife's sister, and that had forced her sister and her child to run away, who they thought Mia Sara and her kid were. So it wasn't so, I mean, I guess it wasn't so much incest. He had had an affair with his sister-in-law, and then their kid was disabled in some way, and he had euthanized it.
I misunderstood that. I didn't catch up. I thought it was his wife had given birth to Arthur.
I'm sure
that would make sense. What you're saying,
and that was why the sister-in-law and the daughter had run away. But then it turns out they're in the well as well. I think that's right. But yeah. Then it's kind of like he's also trying to rape Miyasara to kind of prove his virility to his father, who's in the wheelchair, who's also in National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation, I noted.
Yeah. I thought that was George Burns at first.
No, it's
William Hickey.
Yeah, William Hickey.
Also, like The Burbs and stuff like that.
Oh yeah, he's in The Burbs, isn't he?
One of the things when I saw William Hickey, sometimes I look at him and I think he's like Stripe, the Gremlin from Gremlins. and he's got this like the teeth. This reminds me. Or Billy Drago. He's a bit like an old Billy Drago.
Oh yeah, Billy Drago. Jesus Christ, there's a character.
Yeah. Billy Drago, unfortunately, didn't get a chance to get that old, which is very sad. No. But yeah, I mean, the cast is great, isn't it? I mean. William Hickey sort of rounding it out, but the little girl was really good. I was trying to look up what her name was. I can't remember her character name.
And the end resolution where everyone kind of spectacularly died.
Yep.
that made me funny.
The bit with the wheelchair. That's
the wheelchair, the shotgun, the window. It all comes into play. It made me very happy as a viewer.
It's a weird film. I mean, the cinematography between, you know, the sort of suburban house and the sort of more sort of southern gothic sort of location. It's very sort of chalk and cheese. It kind of reminded me a little bit of Crimes of Passion for some reason, in that sort of. Sort of duality, you know, that's a sort of juxtaposition. But there you go, that's just me. Poor old Chicky, what's his name, the detective?
Chicky Ross.
He has a role. You know, at times this film gets quite gruesome. Which again, you know, it's sort of weirdly weird with the tone of the film, because it plays like a heightened TV movie for a lot of it. And then you get these sudden bursts of, like, you know, sort of slight gore effects coming into it. The finger, you know, the thumbnail thing. Fuck me. stop playing around with your thumbnails. That was pretty horrible.
Oh, that night, the first night where she only realizes she should use the wrench, like the morning after, me and my wife were yelling at the screen going, "The wrench is right there. What are you doing?" And then, you know, realizes it's there like the next day. For God's sake. This woman's useless.
Yep. Any more comments for the maddening?
I would just say that Ty was right. Danny Houston does have more directorial credits than I'd realised. He'd actually made like three films before this and like two films since. So
The Last Photograph in 2017. I did look it up and I forgot to.
But he started his directorial career with Santa Claus, The Making of the Movie, which would be, I guess, the old Dudley Moore Santa Claus, the movie.
The one sponsored by Coca-Cola.
I remember watching. Do you remember? Do you guys remember Entertainment USA?
Yes.
I remember them. What's his name? Jonathan? Can't remember the name of the... Jonathan King, that's right, yeah.
Because they
did a thing about... I think it was at Cannes, actually, where they announced, you know, sort of coming soon, Santa Claus the Movie sort of thing. It's like, it was such a big deal at the time. And then
wasn't it a canon film?
Oh, it just looked dreadful.
Probably.
I think it might be right,
but it was.
I mean, I did love it when I was a kid, to be fair.
Oh, I hated it.
Yeah, but Mike, I was 5 at the time. How old were you?
I'd have been 12, probably.
I love Santa Claus the Movie.
Yeah, I watched it a lot as a kid, but I had no taste. So bah humbug. I can't even defend myself.
Bah humbug.
And I like Supergirl as well.
Oh, I love Supergirl. I got a lot of love for Supergirl and Faye Dunaway in that. Hart Bochner.
Peter O'Toole.
Yeah.
Who is acting up a storm in that film. Never and Peter Cook. Peter it. Cook's in there as well.
Never watched it. Okay, so we don't score the DTV throwbacks. Ghosts, but we do recommend you check them out. This is on Amazon Prime in a nice, pristine sort of version. As Rich said, it's in widescreen. It's a crazy little film, as you heard us talking about it. If you're curious, go check it out. And that is the end of this week's show. So thank you to our special guest, Taiman Singh, for joining us.
Oh, thanks very much for having me, guys. It's been a lot of fun. I mean, you gave me a lot of homework, and some of it was awful, but you know what? The maddening more than made up for it.
Awful to watch, but fun to talk about, I think.
Exactly, yeah.
Ty, before you go, tell us a little bit about one or two of the events you've got coming up with the Bristol Bad Film Club.
Well, the Bristol Bad Film Club is basically we show the greatest bad movies ever made in Bristol. We're doing our first post-COVID event on the 19th of August, and due to public demand and that one's selling out, we're doing another one on the 21st, and we're showing Action USA, which is basically a stuntman showing Hollywood how it's meant to be done, starring Mac's dad from It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. So if you don't live in Bristol, we're also doing a virtual screening of it on the 19th. So our event on the 19th is also getting streamed online. So you can buy a virtual ticket from bristolbadfilmclub.co.uk. And you'll also be able to watch the event and the film live at 8 o'clock on the 19th. It's also, the film's going to be fully captioned because we tried to make our screenings as accessible as possible. So yeah, buy a ticket and you'll be sent a unique URL 24 hours for the event, and you can watch Action USA at home.
Sounds awesome. The trailer is crazy for this.
Oh yeah, it's insane.
Yeah,
it's a good movie.
Yeah, we've been dining on PM Entertainment films recently, so we like our stunt stuff.
Where did you first come across this film, Ty?
Honestly, my friend Rob Hill, who wrote the Bad Movie Bible, he told me about it. And then Draft House Cinema did a 4K re-release in 2019. And I know the guys there, and they sent me a screener of it and, you know, all the details. And I was like, oh my God, how have I never heard of this film before? And it's like when they re-release Raw, Tippi Hedren's film that she made with 30 Lions and Tigers. And why do not enough people know about this film? Why has this film been hidden from us? Why is like in is like 101 one films you must see before you die is Raw not like number one with a bullet? I don't understand. So
I almost got confused with the Day of the Animals with Leslie Nielsen.
Oh, is that Food of the Gods? No, that's a different film. That's it's insane.
Raw is very good. I remember when that came out as well, because they were so banking on the fact that we're using real animals, really up close, you know, all that sort of stuff.
It's crazy. It's amazing. I mean, the behind the scenes story is crazier than the actual film. Jan de Bont, the director of Speed and Twister, was the cinematographer, and he got scalped by a lion.
Shit.
How many people get scalped by a lion making a film? And you can just Google pictures of Jan de Bont raw, and it just shows him missing half his head. And Melanie Griffith had her face torn off and had to have reconstructive facial surgery. Tippi Hedren broke her leg, her husband. Even in the trailer, you can see him getting body slammed by two lions and just stands up and he's bleeding. It's insane. That film is insane. And I love it.
Awesome. Anyway,
just to go back to Action USA for a second. So the film's directed by stuntman John Stewart.
That's right. Yeah.
Who then later directed his
Daily Show? No, different John Stewart.
Yeah, different John Stewart. He later directed his own life story movie. Did you know this?
No.
Fall Guy, the John Stewart story, directed by John Stewart.
Amazing.
And I'm desperate to actually see this, but it's very hard to come by. But so if you ever do come across it, do let us know.
I'm just going to have to track down the trailer now and just show it before the thing.
Taiman, have you ever heard of a film called The Devil Told Me To?
This sounds very familiar. Tell me more.
It's a New Zealand film about a guy wanting to be a stuntman. And again, it's sort of based on a real person, but embellished. a lot, and it has that sort of crazy sort of New Zealand sort of sense of humor to it. I highly recommend it if you can track it down.
I'm going to have to now. This sounds fascinating.
And as we said, that is the end of this week's show. Thanks to Timon for joining us. Thanks to Rich and Steve for having to sit through another interminable group of films, although the God Committee really did surprise us, so please check that out. Otherwise, thank you for listening. Tune in next time.
Thank you for listening to the DTV Digest. Let us know your thoughts in the comments and tune in again next time.